Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Weiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, it's Eric Byler from Durham, North Carolina. I do not have Michael Charney with me tonight, but I have Leland Beaumont, who is the author of the, well, we call it Leland's List, 50 Questions That Politicians Should Have to Answer as They Seek Public Office. If you go to coffeepartyusa.com, you can see the answers. Last week we talked about the questions. This week we're going to talk about the answers. Leland will be joining us in a few minutes. I wanted to open up the middle ground tonight, by telling you a little bit about last night. So in the General Assembly building of the North Carolina legislature, as I predicted actually a week ago, the crowds really exploded to several times the size they had been. About a month ago, 17 people were arrested, many of them reverends and ministers. In the North Carolina General Assembly, it's a rotunda between the House and the Senate chambers, a beautiful fountain. It's sort of like marble, and there's a balcony above that's also round. And the first 17 were protesting in particular voting rights abuses that have been some put into place and others in the process of being put into place. And the way I would kind of introduce you to this, if you weren't aware before, and I think you will be aware soon if you weren't aware before, North Carolina is a state that is going through tremendous demographic shift. It's sort of emblematic of the shifts that the United States are going through. But I think for two reasons, the anxiety here is greater. One, it is the South. And I think race relations in the South have a particular sensitivity that is unlike anywhere else in the United States. And if you've only seen it on TV or in movies, you don't really understand, but you do know, I'm sure, that race relations here are different than other parts of the country. Also, this is a swing state. Barack Obama won North Carolina in 2008, and it was one of the only swing states that he didn't win in 2012, both very close elections. And the state-level politicians here, and also the donors, the sort of Koch brother type of donors who fund them, are really concerned that if the electorate actually matches the population in terms of the ethnic breakdown, they won't be able to control the way people's taxpayer dollars are spent any longer. In other words, they won't be able to write policies for the legislatures the way that I think everyone knows ALEC has been doing in state legislatures across the United States. They're all over North Carolina's legislature. In fact, the president of the Senate is on the board of ALEC. That's right. This corporate body, American Legislative Exchange Council, corporate lobbyists, have one of their board members as the president of the Senate. Tom Tillis is his name in North Carolina. And so what they're trying to do is write policies that do two things. One is try to make sure that that electorate does not mirror the population by passing voter restriction laws that make it harder for certain demographics to make it to the polls. We'll start with college students. They don't want college students to vote because there's the lopsided party affiliation, or at least maybe not affiliation, but in terms of how college students vote, more toward the Democrats. And so they're passing laws that, or they are introducing and contemplating laws that, for starters, if a college student votes in their home district, in other words, where they actually live because they're in college, their parents will be penalized in their tax return because they won't be able to claim them as a dependent. I guess the logic is that if the kid can vote on their own, or if they can register to vote where they live, then they don't really depend on you for health care or sustenance or anything like that. I think if you're going to college, you probably do depend on your parents, because no 19-year-old kid can afford college on their own. But in any case, that's just one of the many laws. They want to do away with Sunday voting. Sunday voting is when African-American churches traditionally have what they call the Souls to the Polls program. They want to crunch early voting down from 19 days to 6 days, hoping to create really long lines at the polls. And long lines at the polls are effective in basically dirty election practices, because what happens then is that the long lines are actually in the population centers. The long lines will be in places where a lot of people of color live, and not just people of color, but people who are not of color, but comfortably live among the people of color. They also swing very much toward the Democrats. And then, of course, in the rural parts of the state, you'll be able to zip in and out when you vote, because there just isn't the population to create those lines. And so it's interesting. It's a customer service question. They're doing things to try to make it easier when you go to the DMV, for instance. They're open on Saturday now. But in terms of voting, they want you to wait as long as possible, especially if you are or live among people of color in North Carolina. And so it started out with a voting rights kind of focus, or maybe that's my prejudice because I care about voting rights a lot. But if you go to a protest now, and I'd say there are about 2,000 people there yesterday, they are talking about every issue under the sun, and it's basically the laundry list of liberal issues. And I think that the Republicans feel they can ignore that because there was an election last year in which Republicans won huge majorities, in fact, veto-proof majorities. So even if the governor, his name is Pat McCrory, wants to seek, you know, the White House or something and wants to come off as more of a centrist Republican, they can override his veto if he doesn't go along with some of these voting restrictions. And I haven't even started to talk about the wealth redistribution, for instance, doing away with an estate tax that affects 23 wealthy families. In other words, it's a tax break for 23 wealthy families, while actually having new taxes, putting in new taxes on the poor. And basically it's on everyone, because it's like food and medicine, things you need to live. They're going to tax those at a higher rate in order to pay for the tax cuts for the 23 wealthiest people in North Carolina. So it's really, the issues have expanded, and so has the diversity of the participants. And so whereas 17 people were arrested 5 weeks ago, it was 151 last night. And Annabelle and I were filming until about 3 a.m., and they still had 57 people left in jail. That's more than had ever been arrested before. So we decided not to stay all night, but we did talk to Nancy Brown, who I hope will call in, but she was, because she stayed up all night, she was fading last time I talked to her. Nancy didn't get home till 6 a.m. She didn't get arrested again, but she did go to support the people who did. And one of them, her friend, was the second to last person to be released, and it was about 5 a.m. So what's the whole point? Where's it going? I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to draw attention to the policies that are being either passed and signed or contemplated in North Carolina. And
as Reverend Barber, who's the leader of the NAACP and really the leader of this movement, has said, and not let the legislators and Alec get away with doing this in the dark. And one last little tidbit about this. I think that it's probably true that the politicians at this point feel like this can just go on and on forever. They're not able to control the media anyway. And here they're sort of losing the media cycle, especially on Mondays, in local news coverage. But they can sort of withstand that because they sort of feel like, well, there was an election, and so people voted for conservative policies. There are liberals who will complain that the districts were gerrymandered so grotesquely to disenfranchise African Americans. In other words, they just packed them all into certain districts so that in all the other districts there was a huge white majority, even though that isn't really a geographic reality. So they had to create these weird chopped up starfish looking districts to connect the black population centers and basically cordon them off into certain districts in the Senate and in the House. But nonetheless, there was an election. And so these are policies that basically come down to the trickle-down economics, you know, the 47% thing. You know, are the people who rely on food stamps or unemployment or Medicaid who don't have health insurance, are those people disposable sort of leeches? Or are they people who, with some assistance, could become more productive, tax-paying members of society that could help lift the state economy up from the bottom up? And so that's sort of the policy issue. And as I was talking with Nancy Brown last week, policy issues are not necessarily something that I would get arrested for, but voting rights is another matter, because I think these Republicans want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to try out the Koch brothers' philosophy, you know, the Ayn Rand philosophy, redistributing wealth from the poor to the rich through the process of government. But if it fails, they don't want the electorate to judge them on that. In other words, they don't want a democracy. They want to be insulated from the judgment of the voters. And so while they have this sort of unique sort of backlash opportunity, right? Barack Obama wins in 2008. The Tea Party ushers in this period of hysteria over demographic shift. They're able to gerrymander for the 2012 election, and then they win the supermajority. They want to use this short window of time to basically create levies against the flood of natural demographic shift as we, as America becomes the America we were always destined to be, and as North Carolina becomes the North Carolina it was always destined to be. This is how they want to delay for as long as possible the time where the vote of the people actually influences the policies that they make. And so with that, I'll bring in Leland. I already have a caller, Leland, because I went on so darn long. But Leland, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you. Very good.
How was my summary? Was that okay?
Fine. I was not in North Carolina, so I cannot comment on that. But yes, it was clear, and I think you're making clear what the issues are, which is, do the representatives represent the people? And it's, you know, to the extent that they're gerrymandering, no. I've actually, you know, I have an engineering background. I actually thought a little bit about whether there's a mathematical thing you could do about a smooth curve that would kind of counterbalance gerrymandering, but I didn't get anywhere with that. But I think also, and you kind of pointed this out, these are the death throes, right? I mean, one measure of power is the extent to which it can move you away from reality. And the people's vote is the reality. The gerrymandering is a distortion of that. And power is doing all it can to move away from that. History is on our side. You know, the long arc of history is on our side, and it will get better. But then there's other, you know, other techniques will come up. So it's a bad thing.
Well, Leland, apparently they cannot hear me very well. So I'm going to ask you to talk about the list.
Okay. Just with respect to hearing you, I could hear you fine until about 5 minutes into it, and then there was a shift in your voice. So so maybe something happened there. But yeah, let me talk about the list, and let me just say that I was on last week. I began thinking about, is there some body of knowledge that we would expect politicians to be conversant with? You expect your doctor to know about anatomy and medicines and so on, and you expect your lawyer to know about law. But is there some body of knowledge that you expect politicians to know about? Also, and this is why I presented it as a list of questions rather than question and answer originally, does a candidate or a politician have the wherewithal to come up with a reliable answer to a question of fact? And in so doing, what would they choose as a reliable reference that they would cite, and so on? All those things are kind of interesting. So we talked through it a little bit last week, and Eric asked me to write out some of the answers. I was reluctant because once I write this down, it becomes Lee's opinion on how old the universe is, as opposed to the age of the universe is a fact. It is as old as it is. There may be some difficulty in measuring it. There may be some discrepancy in measuring it. There may be some variability in measuring it. The measurement may vary over time, but it's not an opinion kind of a question. It's a fact kind of a question. And I am disappointed when journalists insist that there be two sides to every issue. Some issues are two-sided, but very often that draws a false dichotomy. If you're hearing from the black, you have to hear from the white, and it's black or white, as opposed to white and non-white, whereas non-white is the whole spectrum of colors. So enough of that. I will take issue a little bit with the diagram that Eric put up here, with science having empirical data and religion having morality and metaphysics. I argue that empirical data can help us understand morality. For example, thou shalt not kill, which is, you know, kind of has a religious origin, at least the way I state it that way, it does. But you could ask people, would you like to be killed or not? And most of them would say, no, I would not like to be killed. And then you can just use symmetry, which is, well, if they don't like to be killed, maybe I wouldn't like to be killed. And so it's immoral to kill people. You can get to a code of morality by simply looking at empathy and symmetry, which is an empirical-based one. So that was just a little bit to twit Eric before we get started here. So anyhow, what can I do here? I can go through this list here, and I'm going to talk about some that I think are a little bit more fun. One of them here is many years after an acorn is planted, it grows to become a huge oak tree. Where does most of the mass of that tree come from? Anyone want to venture a guess? Eric, are you there? Do you have a guess? You probably read it. People talk about the soil, and they talk about the water, and they talk about the sun, and they talk about the fertilizer. But the truth is that most of the mass, dry mass of a tree, comes from the carbon dioxide extracted from the atmosphere. We all hear the name photosynthesis, and the basic reaction of photosynthesis, if I can use some high school chemistry here, is 6CO2 plus 6H2O, given propelled by sunlight and chlorophyll and so on, gives you sugar plus O2. So trees, since they were first formed, have been extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, sequestering it in their mass, and then as trees die, there's decomposition and so on. And you say, well, fine, that's a nice little fun fact, and who was in their high school and so on. But this has a political impact. This bears on global warming. Consider the following experiment. For 200 million years, we will have plants across the Earth inhaling carbon dioxide, turning it into plant mass, and then those plants, over millions of years, will be compressed into fossil fuels, coal and oil and so on. So 200 years, we've been storing carbon dioxide extracted from the atmosphere, we've been storing sun's energy, and we've been compressing it, and we've been putting it in fossil fuels within the Earth. Now, having stored it for 200 million years, what we're going to do in the following experiment is we're going to take it all out of the earth and burn it into the atmosphere in 200 years. So what is the more conservative estimate of what would happen? Would you estimate that that would have an effect on the atmosphere or that would not have an effect on the atmosphere? When it's phrased that way, it's like a million to one factor. I don't know how you could do that without affecting the atmosphere. But there's a strange logic going on. So for me, that's just kind of a very, very simple way to think about carbon dioxide and fossil fuels and global warming. The next question I have here is, describe your understanding of economic externalities. Give several examples relevant to today's economy. So think about the definition is, it's a cost or benefit which results from an activity or transaction which affects an uninvolved party who didn't choose to incur the cost. So one example we can give would be the owner of a coal mine. You own a coal mine. Your job is to maximize profits for your company. So you want to extract coal as cheaply as possible, and you want to sell that coal at as high a cost as you can. Are there externalities here? Yes, I believe there are several externalities. Coal mining is dangerous. Mines collapse. Miners get black lung, and so on. So mining is dangerous. When a miner is killed in an accident, the cost of that is not reflected directly in the balance sheet of the mining company. The cost of black lung are not directly affected there. So those are certain externalities. There's mine tailings and waste and so on, and then where do they get placed in the landfills and so on. So that's something that happens that's a cost kind of that the mine owner distances himself from. And for those of us that believe in global warming, when that coal is burned, it produces carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere, which increases the insulating properties of the atmosphere and increases the temperature of the earth. So those are many externalities that that pertain to a coal mine. My own belief is that a primary purpose of government and government regulation is to basically put the cost of those externalities back onto the organization that causes it. So in this example, regulations having to do with mine safety, having to do with black lung, having to do with pollution control, you know, dumping of the tailings, and hopefully in charging for putting CO2 into the atmosphere, are all ways to have the externality back onto the cost of the coal. You decided to own a coal mine. You're doing all this stuff. There it is. I think it would be very helpful if many more of the debates about regulations and industry and energy future and all sorts of things were explicitly cast in terms of externalities. You would like to go fracking, that's fine. Step one, let's write down all the externalities of fracking, having to do with water, pollution, having to do with well accidents, having to do with the depletion, the final depletion of a non-renewable resource, having to do with the burning of that. List all of these externalities and sit down and say, fine, you want to run a fracking operation, you want to profit from this, you have a responsibility to your shareholders to profit from this, but who is going to bear the cost of each of these externalities? Let's go through those explicitly. Let's admit that, yes, they are a direct result of your operation. Yes, they are a cost. Yes, they have to get paid for it by somebody. Who needs to pay for that? I think if we could have that level of discussion on a lot of these things that are basically regulatory issues, it would be an informed discussion.
Okay, now I'm going to try to comment, and if it sounds bad, I'm going to bring Neil from Fort Lauderdale on right away. I'm
okay.
Looking at the chat room to see if it sounds okay. Okay.
And I can hear you
okay.
Fine.
Okay, cool. I moved to the other side of McDonald's. I'm at the McDonald's in Durham, North Carolina. I hope there aren't any rabid white supremacists out there because now they know where to find me. Okay, from what you said, it occurred to me that I would feel more confident in government if I felt that it was using all the resources of, you know, being a federal government to apply a scientific approach to these kinds of policies, that they could conduct studies and actually use them, rather than in North Carolina, they basically passed a law last year banning scientific method.
Right, that's
because they didn't want to measure the rise of the coastline, because that they thought that might result in policies that weren't in favor of their donors, right? So,
Eric,
anyway,
on that,
yeah.
I like to pay attention to whether facts are informing opinion, which I like, or whether opinion is informing facts, which is the example you just gave. Okay, there's an opinion out there that global warming is a hoax. In order to sustain that opinion, we need to suppress the data, such as Virginia Beach going underwater, that refutes that, and that's kind of bad. So if you can just pay attention, are the facts informing opinion or opinion informing facts, it's telling.
Well, and that's where it kind of ties into the whole purpose of Coffee Party, and that is to stand up against the corrupting influence of money in politics. Because rather than drawing from the resources of science or of knowledge, the expertise in academia around the globe, you know, what has happened in the last 30 years is that we are drawing instead from the kind of sort of public outcry or the kind of public opinion that can be generated through media products. And, of course, I think that was done because we had this period of time where all the media products were controlled by a particular special interest, the wealthiest of the wealthy. And so they had this huge head start on us. Until social media came along in the last 6-7 years, there really wasn't anything close to a response coming from the people. And so they've got a 30-year head start on things like global warming, and so it gives you some sense to some reason to hope, I think, because now there is a conversation that is independent of what's flowing down from the cable satellites.
Right, and the unleashing of that second information stream, the one you're calling social media, will be good in the long term, but it can be misleading in the short term. You can go on the internet and you can find, you know, proof for any kind of crazy theory out there. And at the end of the day, you need to decide how you decide what you believe. Until people come to that, they basically kind of say, you can prove anything, there are no facts, everything is relative, this is just an opinion, and so on and so forth. That's the bad part, and kind of that's where we are now, and I think that's even kind of being exploited. In the long term, people will come to, I know how I know. This is my theory of knowledge. I know how I know. This is reliable. This is not. This is fact. This is opinion, and so on. But we're not there yet. I sent you, Eric, a thing on Halland's spheres of journalism. And it was an original theory. It said that there's a core of factual information that's not interesting to journalists, things like the Earth is round, and you just wouldn't have a newspaper article about that. And then there's the area of legitimate inquiry, and then beyond that is the fringe things, you know, alien invasions and all that. And that's kind of the way it was. What has happened recently is that core of what might have been considered factual information is being attacked. And a lot of the questions I've chosen here are things that I think are unequivocally in that core, yet they're considered either esoteric or opinion kinds of things. And if you don't have that core to sit on, that's the common ground, that's what we can agree on, that's the reality, then you're free-floating and it can go anywhere. But we'll get back to it.
Well, it would be good if science could be a place where we could find some middle ground. We're going to go to Neil in Fort Lauderdale now. I put in out a call on Facebook for people to let us know what's been going on in the world, because Annabelle and I have been so immersed in the culture war in North Carolina that for the most part I don't even know. So Neil, maybe you can introduce some of the topics that are capturing the nation's attention right now.
No, it's just the usual IRS nonsense. I mean, it's just diversion. I mean, you know, I really, I mean, the media, of course, is owned by the same four corporations that are telling the Republicans to filibuster every infrastructure bill and every jobs bill. If the news wasn't really controlled, like that would be an everyday topic. Global warming is interesting. It's like I've actually heard some people say that global warming, if you believe in global warming, you're unpatriotic and you don't believe in Jesus. They're taking it to such a level of where their opinion is fact. They don't care about integrity. They just basically it's like it's a cult. It's really that's the way I kind of view it. I look into these people's eyes sometimes and I go, are you for real? I mean, this is you're telling me you're blaming Obama for the lack of jobs, but the Republicans filibuster everything. And now Obama today with the three judges for the court at once. That's another thing that's going to be very interesting, because instead of doing just one, he has three very qualified people for the federal court, and now Republicans are yelling foul, and he's trying to, you know, stack the court. But they're just showing over and over again the obstruction, that they don't want anything to get done in this country at all. It really shocks me.
Leland, did you want to respond?
No, I think Neil said it right.
Okay, Neil, I'm gonna keep you on, and I'm gonna bring in another caller from 620 area code. So everybody's mic is on right now. 620, what's your name and where are you calling from and what's on your mind?
Okay, it's Jack Golding from Hugoton, Kansas.
Hey, Jack. And, hey, maybe you could. What else is on the news besides the IRS thing?
Well, I think it's too much emphasis on that, on those three things, these three scandals, and I think the media are falling off for that stuff hook, line, and sinker. They're covering everything everything that they the Fox News. That's what. Republicans are okay. Let me give me a sentiment. Republican, I have a 2.5-year-old great grandchild. Republicans are, I'd say, Boehner, Cantor, all the whole entire 60 Tea Party people, and most of the other Republican establishment are acting like they're 2.5-year-old. 2-year-olds. They like this. No is their favorite word. Just as I think you're saying no.
Jack, I've got a current events Kansas question for you. The tornadoes, by the way, my daughter, her husband, and 2-year-old granddaughter live in Kansas. So we pay special attention to the tornadoes that have been coming through here. Is there any discussion in Kansas or Oklahoma that the tornado activity, number one, is perhaps unusually great, and number two, is possibly a symptom of GW, global warming?
Well, I don't think they mentioned global warming. I think Kansas, as you say, is a
conservative.
Very conservative Republican state. One of the most red, my district is southwest corner of Kansas, is one of the most reddest of them all. And they don't, they mention global warming, well, they'll laugh at you.
Right.
That's the impression I would get. And okay, talking about Oklahoma, what's the guy's name who's Kirpin and Inhofe? They both say, well, you should have to make this up, even in Oklahoma, for I got about maybe a $2 billion. $2 billion loss in terms of homes and stuff like that, and they need to need to set aside, my opinion is they need to set aside a certain amount of money for disasters like earthquakes and tornadoes and fires. We have fires in California. That's a big fire in around where I used to live in the San Fernando Valley, a little north of there. And they should need to set aside money for that, and don't worry about offsetting. The sequencher is it's a joke, and they got to have their. I mean, these Tea Party type people, we got to get their way. It's my way or the highway, and they're acting like 2 year olds.
You know, there was a lot of talk, including on this show, after the outcome of the 2012 election, that instead of the sort of hysterical, angry, fact-free reaction that we saw after the 2008 election, they might go the other way and invest those really, 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 you know, big, big dollars, the kind of Koch brothers industry type of dollars, the ruling class dollars, in sort of a re-education, you know, of the Fox News, Rush Limbaugh audience that, I don't know, finds a way to focus on issues without hatred or fear or anxiety and misinformation. Kind of the stuff that John McCain was doing before he was forced
to
the right.
Yeah, I think he's getting back to what he was doing in 08 and trying to be the adult along with Lindsey Graham and maybe a few others, moderates, if we have any moderate Republicans. I think the only moderate Republicans I know about is Olympia Snow isn't around anymore. It's what's her name? The other sister from Maine.
Susan Collins. Yeah.
Peyton Collins.
Yeah.
And Susan Collins and maybe I don't know. I don't know what's left.
Well, I think they're out there, and thank you for the call, Jack. I think they're out there. But my experience has been that in a period where especially the Republican airwaves, whether it's Fox News or radio stations, are dominated by the extreme right, the moderate Republicans are very they're very reluctant to be honest about their opinions. And it's just a survival game for them, and it's not entirely unscrupulous, because if they did just become Democrats, or they did just retire from the party, or they got defeated in the primary because of their honesty, that wouldn't necessarily do their district or their country any good, because the person replacing them would be another person who is a consumer of right-wing propaganda. We got a 404 area code. Leland and Neil, you're still with us.
Yep.
And 404, I think I know who this is. Bobby, is that you?
It is. Good evening, Eric, everybody, Neil. How's everybody this evening? Wanted to chime in on, you were asking about current events. I wanted to just bring you up to speed on a couple of things that I've been paying attention to lately. Today, Condoleezza Rice entered in the Syrian debate. She is advocating U.S. direct military intervention into Syria, so the drumbeat is starting there. The military sexual assault hearings are going on right now, and the distinguished senator from Georgia actually made the excuse in the hearings that because the guys are 17 to 22 years old entering in the military, they have raging hormones, and that's one of the reasons why these things happen. You know, I just can't believe some of the things that come out of our elected officials' mouths.
Are you talking about Jeff Sessions, Bobby?
I'm talking about Saxby, Chambliss.
Oh, no. Saxby said that?
Saxby said that. Sessions is Alabama.
Right, no, that's why I thought you got it wrong, because I heard Sessions was the one who blamed it all on porn.
I didn't hear Sessions, but I heard Saxby, and good old Saxby, he says, the young folks that are coming into most of your services are anywhere from 17 to 22 or 3, gee whiz, the hormone level created by nature, sets in place the possibility for these types of things to recur, and I'm like, really? You didn't just say that. Oh, my God. I'm just like, you know. And then, of course, all the military members that are in the hearing, you know, they're sitting across the row of the table. I think there's like 15 of them. And only one of the service members at the table is a woman. You know, we just don't get it. We just don't get it. So, you know, that's going on. There is an article in North Carolina covering what you're covering. I don't know if you've seen this one, but the governor, who's a Republican, obviously, and the local DA, who's a Democrat, are complaining that these protests are costing a lot of money. These unlawful demonstrations are draining the coffers and are having an impact, taking officers away from really fighting crime and threatening to overwhelm the already overburdened courts in the state capitol. You know, that's in the News Observer. What's going on there is actually making some headway. And there was another article put out by the AP involving marijuana, pretty much confirming that it's about 50-50 white and black across the country as far as pot usage, but pot arrests are up for blacks almost 4% more. So those are just some of the highlights that I saw today, along with the things you guys have already talked about.
Well, it's very interesting that they're concerned about public safety when it involves people's constitutional right to protest. And it is true that when law officers are doing something other than public safety, it puts a stress on the force. And that was one of the reasons why all the anti-immigrant laws that were being pushed around the country, Alabama, Arizona, of course, you saw it in Prince William County, Virginia, in the film Annabelle and I Did.
Sure.
That is a huge drain of public safety resources when you have officers doing immigration status checks instead of, trying to prevent crime. What you have in the General Assembly, though, is, well, there is sort of a necessity for public safety there as well, because when you have crowds of people, there's a potential there could be a counter protest, and so you do need those public safety officers. So they still are, they are definitely providing a public safety service. I think what the people are saying is that they prefer there not be protests, is what they're really saying. But if they prefer there not be protests, they should probably back down on some of these laws that are trying to abuse and abridge voting rights. So,
yeah.
This is Lee. Hello?
Just on a quick note, also in the paper in North Carolina, just talking about North Carolina, the House has just approved a measure that would clear the way for executions to resume in the state. Another little thing that's going on there.
This is Lee, and I wanted just to maybe give a little comment on Bobby had talked about what I'll call obstructionist Republican congressman, my characterization, not his. As it turns out, I went to first grade through 12th grade with a fine young man who became a congressman for 12 years. And I'm not going to give his name just because what he told me, to some extent, may have, you know, I don't know what publicity he wanted on this. I'm just not going to say his name, but it doesn't really matter. I saw him at a high school reunion recently, and I've known him for long enough that he was willing to talk to me as a friend, as we, you know, would have in high school. And I started the conversation by saying, with you out of Congress, are there any statesmen left in there? And he kind of laughed at that. And we had a long discussion, and I asked him about this phenomenon about block voting and signing up for pledges and these kinds of things. And what he pointed out is this. Basically, Republicans are afraid of being primaried on the right. So during the primaries, the turnout for primaries is very, very low. It's like 10% at most of the electorate. And the people who turn out for those primaries are typically polarized, very far to the right or very far to the left. And if you do not make it through the primary, it's all over. So because there's very little turnout during the primaries, and the people who turn out are not centrists, in order to win the primary, you need to move far to the right or to the left. And his final statement to me, he says, Lee, if you want to change the world, go vote in a primary. So I pass on that little advice from this former congressman who's kind of a pretty smart, pretty level-headed guy. And it's something to think about. That there's a systematic mechanism in there that causes it to work the way it does, or to not work the way it does.
Well, there's no question that that's right. I actually wasn't the one who brought it up, but be that as it may, there's no question that that's right, because even in the presidential primary, Romney moved in order to make that work.
Oh, absolutely.
And in the primaries, absolutely. I mean, considering, for example, if you look at just some of the polarized characters that were put into position to be elected, that cost the Republicans Indiana and Missouri, for example. It was the primaries that put those people out there, and of course, those two seats were in play for the Republican Party. There is no question about that. They actually won the states in the presidential level, and if it wasn't for the type of candidates that they would have had two more seats in the Senate, I believe.
Well, okay, this is Eric again. So for the rest of the show, we're going to end in about 12 minutes, right on the hour. All the mics are open, and nobody is at the control board, so you guys will have to be polite. My point is, because I've got Annabelle wants to film something, I got to run over to this public hearing that she's at. But my point on this primary thing, and it's a great point, it's one of the big reasons why we have this problem, because the people who are extreme on the political end of the spectrum, especially on the right, they are so beholden to the media products they consume. But again, I think that is what gives me hope, because if the establishment sort of ruling class Republicans, if the money guys who pay for all that stuff want to compete for the White House ever again in the history of America, they've either got to do what they're doing in North Carolina, which is basically reinstitute Jim Crow, or they're going to have to coach these people on how to cope with modern-day America, whether it be science or diversity or liberation of women. They have to learn how to cope with these things, which do come with certain anxieties for white men. And they're just going to have to teach them that this is not the end of the world, it's the evolution of the world. And I see Fox News starting to do that. They've been doing it on immigration. My fear is that because political advertising disguised as news is also a business, because it's also, about selling commercial, ad space for other products besides politics, then what happens is that they'll run with stuff that gives people more of what they're used to. And what they're used to is absolute fact-free partisan BS. And so, unfortunately, I think that's why we've been talking about some of these Benghazi IRS things ad nauseum, because really they've conditioned their audience to want that. And so now these kind of ruling class figures are going to have to decide, are we going to turn the boat, or are we just going to keep chugging toward this, angry, misinformed regional political party that's going to basically require a third party to emerge in order to balance Democrats. Otherwise, we're going to have one-party rule, and everything will get really corrupt. So That's my out. Now, you guys have the show for the last... I'll be listening, but you guys have the show for the last 10 minutes.
Right,
The one thing you guys... topic you guys missed is that the Supreme Court viewed that the police can swab somebody in their mouth to identify...
Oh.
To see if they committed a crime. Now, I'm worried about people being framed. Even though I understand it's the 21st century, that's how they view it as a 21st century extension of the Fourth Amendment, that it's legal, I think it's a great way to frame somebody.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Neil, I've been talking about it all day. I can't believe I forgot about it. You know, it actually does two things about that I would add to this real quick. One is the reasoning for the ruling, the legitimate government interest against the protection of rights, it opens up another avenue to expand upon that reasoning. It's the same reasoning that they use where you can't yell fire in a movie theater, for example, about free speech. Legitimate government interest, which has been used in so many cases to erode rights, sometimes too much, it was used in this case, and it's going to open up the door the things that we're already conscious of. And the other thing that's really interesting about this ruling is the dissent, which has been more publicized than the actual ruling, unfortunately, but the dissent was written by Scalia and joined by the three women liberals. So it's one of the few times that I ever remember me even paying attention to, or I shouldn't say that, but liking something that Scalia wrote. It's a wonderful dissent, actually. He's absolutely right on target. And he broke away from the conservatives on this particular ruling.
When I heard the ruling, yesterday morning, I heard it and I kind of said, "Good, I'm glad to hear that." I think in terms of facts of our friends, if you're innocent, you've got nothing to worry about here. DNA is such a good investigatory tool, and I was very happy about it. I was surprised by two things. One was the conservative. Liberal split that you had just mentioned. It was very weird. But the other thing that gave me pause was Barry Schecht, who is the attorney who's been leading the Innocence Project. He has used DNA to prove the innocence of something like 175 convicts. He came out against the ruling, which really surprised me.
Because it's a due process problem, is why. It's not. I mean, I get what you're saying. I get why you like it. But when it comes to the standard of legality, it's a due process problem. They have basically circumvented a process again. It's the same thing that they did with the secret courts when they expanded the listening device rules in the Patriot Act. Essentially what they did is they took a law that had secret courts to allow for some due process, and they removed the secret courts and just allowed it to be an executive decision. So they removed the balance from the procedure, which is exactly what they did here, because the law said – what they were appealing is the fact that you had to get a search warrant to do it. And so it isn't that they weren't able to do it, it's that they eliminated the probable cause aspect, which erodes the right. That's why Barry's upset about it.
Right.
Come on now, there's three of us. We can't be quiet.
Well, I mean,
there are no more opinions out there. I'll talk about the commons and the tragedy of the commons for you.
I just think that it's a slippery slope. I mean, I see why it was expanded, but it just seems like that it's giving too much power to the police. And I think there would be a great opportunity for framing to basically use. I don't know. It just seems a little insidious.
How would you, if you were framing somebody, what would you do?
You can mix up genetic samples. Genetics has come such a long way. You could swab somebody and switch it and basically hide the evidence. It would be very easy to do. I don't know
that you would get enough of their DNA to do that.
I don't know. I mean,
so in a rape case, I mean, there's a substantial amount of DNA presumably from the semen. That's a lot. I don't know how you would fake that.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not talking about rape. I'm talking about, let's say there was somebody who was protesting the government. The government didn't like this person protesting. They could frame them. I mean, maybe it's a little out there, but that's what went to my mind when I heard, because it just seems that the Fourth Amendment. I mean, ever since the Patriot Act and the NDAA, I think the Constitution has been slowed down quite a bit. We think that we're free, but we really are not. There's a lot of things that are going on that domestic spying, and with all the technology we have, we've lost really privacy. We've lost, I think, pretty much the I mean, everybody rails against the Second Amendment, but no one talks about the First. No one talks about the Fourth.
Right.
I don't get that. They're like, oh, we have guns. I'm like, great, you have guns. You're going to take on the government who has weapons that are way beyond what you could ever possess. And you're not worried about people, your Fourth Amendment to you know, habeas corpus. You're not worried about habeas corpus, but you want to make sure you have an M16. It boggles the mind. And also the whole genetically modified organism thing, which is just another topic. It just really freaks me out, too, that both parties are so ingrained in trying to seem to poison the food supply.
This is Lee. My thinking on that has evolved somewhat. It started when Stuart Brand, and if you're old enough, you might remember the Whole Earth Catalog, which was edited by Stuart Brand. Stuart Brand has been on the forefront of progressive thinking and ecological thinking for all his life. He actually lives on a tugboat in San Francisco. But he came out with a book recently, and in it he takes a lot of interesting positions, but one of them is in favor of genetically modified crops. He basically says it is the fast track to getting efficient crops. And then by chance, I just actually took a course on genetics at Coursera. And the guy there was absolutely clear about the good things that can come with it. My concern is the overlap between the technology of genetic engineering by genetics or whatever, and the overreach of large corporations. That's what scares me. And, you know, Monsanto kind of went too far with their Roundup and with their seeds that expire and that kind of stuff. If you could, and this is the rub, if you were certain that the corporations were using this to improve well-being rather than simply ramp up profits blind to any well-being, then it would be wonderful. And that's kind of the crux of it. So genetically modified organisms, but the use of those or the control of those by large corporations. And I realize it's difficult to separate them, so maybe you have to delay the technology. But it seems important to talk about that as distinction.
Well, I have to tell you that even if it was the being done only for good, my issue with this is as much about my own personal right to choose as much as anything. You know, my first thing about Monsanto, as I always say, and the GMO issue, is that, number one, you know, our parents called organic food. You know,
right.
So, you know, that's number one. Number two is that the only reason why this is really an issue is because of the corporate personhood status, which allows for them to be thought of in the law by the courts and the legislature and the executive as having the same rights as you and I. Again, what's interesting is you take the balances where the Monsanto Protection Act says, well, the states can't enact any laws that require labeling, which is absurd. And I'm saying, okay, I want to know what's in my food, make them label it. How does it hurt them?
Yeah. That's clear. I mean, the transparency is absolutely essential.
Well, one Monsanto executive basically summed it up. By the way, it was banned in Peru today. He said if we gave people the choice, we might as well put skull and crossbones on the product because that's the truth. They would destroy their business. Because I even called General Mills because of the whole thing with the biracial Cheerio commercial, and I said to her, I'm very proud of what you did, but I won't eat your products because of GMO, and she didn't even know what GMO was.
Really?
I had to explain. She had no clue what a genetically modified organism means, and I said to her, I'm very proud of your commercial, but I cannot eat your products in good faith. But the thing is, yeah, it is an overreach, and we're not having a choice. It's like basically saying, if you like it or not, you know, the whole thing with the wheat that came out in Oregon and how Japan and Thailand and now various other Far East countries will not take our wheat. It was not supposed to be done. It was done completely. It was caught that they made this genetically modified wheat that wasn't supposed to be happening.
Right. Same thing with the meat, the recent meat purchase by China. That's all tied together, and now it's going to have effect on the way the exports are done in the meat business because, of course, they don't accept the hormones that are used by our farmers.
Right.
And that is part of this whole package of this big Smithfield buy that has been coming out. It's all tied together. It's and we as and our great country our alleged great country anyway, the way we act sometimes, doesn't get it in the name of money, money and corporate personhood. It's just absurd to me.
Guys, we have one more minute. Actually, we don't have one more minute. If you've got the closing remarks, make them quickly. Otherwise, we're going to wrap it up here.
I just thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you gentlemen.
All right.
And thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. This ends tonight's episode of Middle Ground on Coffee Party Blog Radio. Thank you very much.
Good night.